This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening. My name is Neil Henry. I'm a professor and dean for the next 18 months at the Graduate School of Journalism, and I'd like to welcome you all here. It's a pleasure to have our visiting journalist, one of the great esteemed writers in the country, as our writer in residence for the next couple of days at this school. I'm not sure what yesterday's elections proved, but it seems pretty clear that the Democratic race, at least, is certainly going to go down to the wire all the way to the convention. It's an exciting time in politics, with history being made in the campaigns of both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, and it's an equally exciting time to be a journalist now covering these races. Bob Herbert is a veteran of this coverage, and it's often been quite illuminating and a delight for me to read his coverage on the op-ed pages of the New York Times as he has followed the campaign in places as far flung as New Hampshire, South Carolina, and certainly in California. As those of you who follow his work, you may know he's been a pretty consistent critic of the Bush administration for these past 7 years.
I deny it.
But like all great opinion writers in American journalism, his work is based not strictly on what he feels in his heart, but on reporting and information gathering. We live at a time in a digital age where opinion is obviously practically everywhere and cheap. What's truly valuable in opinion writing and journalism is the knowledge, the news, and the evidence one bases his or her views on. And it's that kind of hard work of reporting that is most valuable to consumers of information. Just the other day, for example, Bob, for his latest column, was spending time at that arch-rival university across the bay to inform his work, talking to students and others at Stanford about the mood of the electorate there the day before the primary. While at Berkeley for the next couple of days, he's already made appointments to talk to professors on campus and the sociology department and elsewhere about some larger contextual trends that may be behind the issues in this campaign and what's driving the candidates. He has been a stalwart in particular at the crossroads in his work of race, urban affairs, justice, and injustice in American society, and throughout these past few years has been a warrior in particular on these issues against the Bush administration. When I invited Bob to visit Berkeley while he was out here visiting, covering the campaigns, and invited him to give a talk about his work, the election seemed a no-brainer because it's the one day after Super Tuesday, of course. But I also thought, both of us, that it might be a good idea to consider the future, too, and what we might expect in the next few years after, beyond the Bush administration and the crises that have marked its tenure. The short facts about Bob's career are these. He's a graduate in journalism from the State University of New York. He's been a reporter for the Newark Star-Ledger and a reporter and editor for the New York Daily News. He's been a national correspondent for several years for NBC News. He's been a Pulitzer Prize jury chairman. He has also taught at Brooklyn College and the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. He is the winner of numerous prestigious awards, and for the last 13 years, an op-ed columnist for what many consider the most valuable real estate in American journalism, which is the New York Times editorial page. Today marks the first time Bob has ever really spent time in Berkeley, and it's my honor to introduce him here as our writer in residence.
I'm always afraid nobody's going to show up. So we got that part out of the way. More and more now, they refer to me as a veteran, which means you're old. What I think I'll do is just a few comments, very short, off the cuff, about the election, and then I have a prepared talk, and then I'll be happy to answer whatever questions anybody might have. The first thing I would say about the election, who's that? The first thing I would say about the election is that I've been covering this stuff for a long time, and this one is really exciting. And I think that for the younger people, you don't always know when you're a participant in history. And I've been there, I've been there a few times, and most of the time completely oblivious to the fact that I was living through some profound historical period. And then you look back and you go, whoa, I can't believe what was going on, and that I saw some of it, and in fact, I've covered some of it. Well, this is one of those moments. This transition from the post-Bush era on the one hand, and then the idea that we're moving into the early part of the 21st century on the other hand, because I think centuries like decades don't start immediately. I think it takes a little bit of time for them to get underway. So one of the things you're witnessing now, and I think it's a privilege to do so, is the development of the face of the United States of America in the early part of the 21st century. So think about the transition from the 19th to the 20th century. Think about the transition from World War II into the post-war era. Think about the transition from the time of the Kennedy-Nixon campaign in 1960 into those turbulent decades that were to follow. This is something that's on that scale, so pay close attention. I think that because of the way the media covers things, it's pretty easy to lose perspective on what's been happening with the Barack Obama candidacy, what I've been calling the Barack Obama phenomenon. And I've been saying, and this is how I personally feel, that irrespective of whether Obama gets the Democratic nomination or becomes president, what he's done so far is just astounding. And it wasn't too long ago where I would guess most people in this room would never have believed that Obama could come as far as he has come, even to date. And it is not simply the fact that this is a black guy who has a reasonable shot at winning the White House, which is astonishing enough. But to me, very significant is the fact of the way that he's going about this. That what Obama is doing, I think, is beginning to shape the way politics is going to move forward in this country over the next several years. When he uses that mantra of change, which we've heard so much about now, it's in danger of becoming a cliche and then it just goes by you, but it really is important. When he uses that mantra of change, I think two things. The first is that he's talking about a change from the way this country has been doing things over the past several years, and whether somebody wants to vote for Obama for president or not, I think there's an awful lot of people in this country who are fed up with the way things have been done over the past several years, so they'd like to move on to something different and more constructive. But beyond that, I think when he talks about change, that he is much less an agent of change and, in fact, is tapping into changes that are already there, already underway, and some of those changes are powerful. And I've been looking at it sort of in a way to simplify it and make it easier for me to get my hands around it. I've been looking at it from, especially from the perspective of the generational divide. And it just seems to me that the people who are on my side of the divide, which, sad to say, I feel is the wrong side of that divide, but the people who are on my side of the divide are carrying with them sort of concepts and ideas and resentments and views about race and gender and ethnicity and partisan politics and all kinds of other hostilities that the younger generation, at least to the extent that I've been observing them and in some cases interviewing them, don't seem to be carrying, that there is a different way of looking at things in the younger generation. And one of the things that I've sort of consoled myself with, I think that that is a good thing, the new way people are looking at things, younger people. But one of the things I've been consoling myself with is that I, and I would imagine a lot of people in this room and a lot of other people I know and millions of others who have been just sort of staunch in the idea that you have to fight racism and misogyny and ethnic hatred and all things along those lines, who believe in the sort of the ideals that the United States is supposed to stand for, and who have stood up for those ideals in the face of some pretty bitter opposition at times. I think that we can take a little consolation in the fact that by standing up to those things over the years, we're winning, that there has, in fact, been a transition, that this country is in a much better place now than it was on these issues in the 1940s and the 1950s and the 1960s and even the 1970s, that we helped create a world where the kids of today can hold the views that they hold now, who don't have the baggage that maybe a lot of us carried with us out of that period. And I think that, you know, we might even go so far as to congratulate ourselves a little bit on a job well done. Despite the 8 years of the Bush administration, we're in a better place now than we were some time ago. So now on to the prepared part of my text. This part of my talk could be subtitled A Call to Civic Engagement. I'm going to try and show you that this is a country, despite my optimistic comments of a moment ago. Now I'm going to bring you down. I'll try and bring you up a little bit later. If that doesn't work, you can throw stuff at me. But I am going to try and show you that despite certain reasons for optimism, that this is a country in deep trouble, I think even in crisis, and that the American dream, so this is a little broader than the idea of the perspective that younger generations may be bringing to the political process, for example, but in a lot of other ways, the American dream is in jeopardy. And I'll be covering a lot of things that may seem unrelated. I'm a columnist after all, but stay with me. There is a point to what might seem at times like my columnist madness. I love those stupid criminal stories that you see on the web. And one of my favorites is about a guy in South Carolina who became impatient as he was coming to the end of a 4-month prison term. And so with just 3 hours left in his term, 3 hours before he was to be released, he thought, seeing an opportunity to escape, that it would be a good idea to seize that opportunity. And so he bolted from a recreation session, and he fled. He escaped with 3 hours left. This is a true story on his sentence. That is a quintessential example of bad decision-making. The escapee was soon captured, sent back to jail for another 6 months, which was 2 months longer than his original sentence. Then there was the ex-convict, excuse me, who robbed a bank and was surprised when the police showed up later at his home and arrested him. "How'd you know it was me?" he asked. "I used the juice." The cops had no idea what he was talking about. It turned out that he had rubbed lemon juice on his face because someone had told him that that would make it impossible for the security cameras to record his image. He went into the bank thinking of himself as the Invisible Man. One more. A guy stole a car, and when the victim described it, she told the police that it had a phone in it. So a cop called the number. The thief answered. The cop said, I saw your ad in the newspaper, and I was interested in buying your car. Sure enough, they made an appointment. The thief showed up. And he was arrested on the spot. These are amusing examples of utter incompetence, and they're funny because the consequences are not that horrendous. Things seem a lot less funny when we watch a great country like the United States fall into what I think right now is a state of crisis, largely because of the incompetence of our leadership. This is hardly a nation that is flourishing. The great promise of the United States, which seemed to be reaching fruition in the post-World War II period, has run aground. We all remember the awful images coming out of New Orleans in the summer of 2005 in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I can't think of that tragedy without thinking how much of that suffering and loss of life was unnecessary. Excuse me. New Orleans was a city sacrificed on the altar of incompetence. Leaders at the local, state, and national level had long understood that a catastrophic flood was likely to strike that bowl-shaped city. Everyone knew how vulnerable New Orleans was. It sat below sea level, shoved up against the mighty Mississippi River and Lake Pontchartrain. But as Newsweek noted, quote, though more than 100,000 residents had no way to get out of the city on their own, New Orleans had no real evacuation plan. Katrina wasn't even the monster Category 5, 4 or 5 storm when it hit the city. It was a Category 3 hurricane. But the city was so poorly protected and ill-prepared that it was all but destroyed. Douglas Brinkley, the historian who lives in New Orleans, and he wrote a remarkable book on the flood called The Deluge, offered this terrible indictment. This is a quote. What people don't yet fully comprehend, he said, was that the overall disaster, the sinking of New Orleans, was a man-made debacle resulting from poorly designed levees and flood walls. I remember standing in the middle of the lower Ninth Ward more than a year after the storm and having the feeling that I'd stepped into the aftermath of some kind of nuclear hell. That's how extensive the devastation was. I had never seen anything like that anywhere in my reporting. And what I kept thinking as I stood in the fading light of a gloomy December afternoon, as I looked at the endless city blocks, devoid of people and denuded of housing, as I looked at this apocalyptic American disaster, I kept thinking this never had to happen, that all of this could have been prevented. What gets missed in the 24-hour news cycles and the endless tedium of politicians bickering and singing their own praises is the human toll that results from bad decisions made by people in high public office. Excuse me. The politicians don't even acknowledge that they've made any bad decisions. Just like President Bush told his FEMA director, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, the Republicans are out there on the campaign trail telling the American people that we're winning the war in Iraq. That is outlandish. If the media could bring itself to take its cameras off of Britney Spears for a moment and focus instead, for example, on the GI struggling to overcome paralysis or the amputation of limbs or blindness or depression at the Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, or if we could get a close-up look at the families of the scores of thousands of Iraqis who have been killed in this war that we started for no good reason, and if we were willing to look honestly at the real economic costs of this war, $2 trillion and counting, to be paid for by your children and grandchildren, because we are sure not paying for it. If we could somehow look at that and manage to understand it, we might not be so quick to claim victory. Now, don't get me wrong. Politicians can be entertaining. I've covered enough of them. I get a kick out of I get as much of a kick as the next person from their foolishness. I remember Dan Quayle. We all remember Dan Quayle. Or maybe we don't. Maybe we do. Some of us remember Dan Quayle. And I remember he made a trip to the South Pacific, and one of his stops was in American Samoa. This was in 1989. And there he told the natives, and this is the Vice President of the United States talking to the natives of American Samoa, so this is a bit of a weird confrontation to start with. Anyway, much to the embarrassment of Quayle's aides, this was his message to the natives of Samoa. Quote, "You all look like happy campers to me." "Happy campers you are. Happy campers you have been. And as far as I'm concerned, happy campers you will always be." That's the Vice President of the United States. That's a literal quote, folks. From there, he went on to Pongo Pongo, only he called it Pogo Pogo. The first President Bush may not have wanted to be outdone in the foolishness department by his vice president. He once told us, unfortunately, this too was a quote, "It has been said by some cynic, if you want a friend in Washington, get a dog. But I didn't need that because I have Barbara Bush." A very unfortunate comparison. Anyway, we can get a good laugh from the foolishness sometimes. But we've got some truly serious issues, some very tough issues to deal with in this country. And they're not being honestly addressed by the White House, by the media, or frankly by the presidential candidates of either party. Let's take a step back. Bear with me here now. Take a step back for a moment, a step back in time, to get another look at what I mean by the very personal toll that these foul-ups, bad decision-making, and incompetence at the highest levels of government can take on people at the lowest levels, very ordinary Americans, which is what I certainly was back in 1965 when, with Vietnam raging, I was drafted into Lyndon Johnson's army. This is a piece I wrote for the New York Times on the 25th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam, and it carried the headline, "A Fool's Errand." Paul Conover and I met Michael Farmer during basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey in the mid-1960s. Conover and I were friends from Montclair. Farmer was a kid from Atlantic City, a 17-year-old who mumbled so badly you could never be sure what he was saying. He was big and good-looking, but the first impression was that he wasn't too swift. One night, Farmer came over to the barracks, uninvited, while Conover and I, who were a couple of years older and light years cooler, were sitting on the floor, spit-shining our combat boots. Every time I read that line, I wonder, how cool do you have to be sitting on the floor, spit-shining your combat boots? But that's what I wrote. Very tentatively and very politely, Farmer asked if he could join us. I told him to get lost. Farmer must not have understood because he promptly sat down, took off his boots, and over the next few minutes proved, to my satisfaction, that he was as dumb as he sounded. First, he told us that he had joined the army. Conover grinned and rolled his eyes. Then Farmer said he was in love with a girl in Atlantic City and planned to marry her. I shook my head. This was not a person worth spending time with. As a draftee, all I wanted was for my hair to grow back. Same thing I want now. All I wanted was for my hair to grow back and to be reunited with that gleaming symbol of freedom and the good life, my Thunderbird. But Conover liked Farmer and told him to come back the next night. He mumbles, I said, but Conover said, he's all right. So Farmer came back night after night to smoke cigarettes, listen to Motown music, mumble about his girlfriend, and polish boots. To my chagrin, I started to like him, though I still needed a translator to understand him. For the longest time, I thought his girlfriend's name was Merlin. It was Marilyn. Farmer and Conover became very close. Eventually, both of them were sent to Vietnam. I got lucky and was sent to Korea, which was no walk in the park, but it was not Vietnam. The impact of the war on Conover and Farmer was strange. When Farmer came back, he seemed more sure of himself, more open and fun-loving, less insecure. He and Marilyn were married. Conover, the most happy-go-lucky guy I had ever known, was a wreck. He was nervous, jumpy. Some nights he would drink like a fiend. The cheerful optimism that had once defined his personality was gone. He wouldn't really talk about Vietnam. All I ever heard him say was, "Didn't know I could get so scared." Then the unthinkable happened. Farmer, who had enlisted for 4 years and was still in the service, got orders to go back to Vietnam. We told him not to go. "Call your congressman," we said. "Fight this thing." But Farmer didn't know how. It's not hard to guess what happened. Farmer's second tour lasted only a few months. I was in the back of my father's upholstery shop one afternoon when Conover walked in. "Farmer didn't make it," he said, and he started crying. A year passed. I got a job with a newspaper. Conover got married. Other buddies got killed in the war, which began to look like it would go on forever. My sister's boyfriend got shot. I didn't realize it, but Conover's struggle was winding down. He wouldn't make it either. I never got the story straight. All I know is that he got his hands on a gun, and one night he waited in a car outside his house for his wife to come home. And when she showed up, he shot her dead, and then he killed himself. Sunday was the 25th anniversary of the end of the war, which I cannot think about without thinking of Farmer and Conover. Neither had a clue about the politics or the history or the egos that sucked them up like dust from a carpet and consigned them to their pointless fates. Vietnam was a fool's errand, and the young and the ignorant went to their doom by the tens of thousands. When David Brinkley, appalled by the carnage, asked Lyndon Johnson why he didn't just pull out of Vietnam, thus saving many lives, Johnson replied, "I'm not going to be the first American president to lose a war." A couple of years ago, I visited the Vietnam Memorial in Washington. I found Farmer's name and then, not thinking, looked for Conover's. Of course, it wasn't there. But his short life and that of his wife, whose name I don't know, were wasted by Vietnam just as surely as the lives of those 58,000 other Americans listed on that bitter wall. If we've learned any lessons from the Vietnam experience, I don't know what they are, because here we are, bogged down in another insane, unwinnable war, a war that has already lasted longer than our involvement in World War II. And we're treating the troops who are fighting the war in Iraq worse than those who fought in Vietnam. My friend Michael Farmer was killed because he was forced to serve 2 terms in the combat zone in Vietnam. In Iraq, because we don't have a draft, which would mean an endless supply of cannon fodder, we're sending the soldiers and Marines into combat for 3, 4, and even more tours. That's playing Russian roulette with their lives, and it's unconscionable. One of my reasons for talking so much about the war in Iraq is that it stands like a boulder in the road, blocking progress on so many other issues that are crucial to our viability as a society. There's nothing secret about these issues. We're going through tough economic times. Good jobs at good pay are increasingly hard to find. For many workers, paid vacations are a fantasy, and employer-paid health benefits will soon be a relic of a distant industrial past. The subprime mortgage crisis is causing tremendous hardship, not just for the poor and working classes, but for many middle-class Americans as well. We're hostages to our reliance on increasingly expensive foreign oil. The public schools in many places, especially the large cities and rural areas, are a mess. The fortunate youngsters who succeed in getting through 4 years of college are often saddled with debt that will take them the better part of a lifetime to pay off. And as if all that wasn't bad enough, global warming is threatening to fry all of us to a crisp. I like Al Gore, but I get scared every time I see him on television. It's like holding up a sign, "The end is near." Like, it's really frightening. You know, it wasn't always like this. Archibald MacLeish and Arthur Miller liked to say that the essence of America was its promise. This was the place where the next generation was always going to be smarter, better educated, healthier, and more prosperous, just flat out better off than its parents and grandparents' generation. There was general agreement that that was how it should be, and in fact, there was a name for it, the American Dream. I consider myself the poster child for the American dream. I was born right at the end of World War II, the first of the baby boomers. For me and my peers, a good education was cheap and readily available. Good jobs were plentiful, even for those who didn't have a college degree. I walked into a newspaper office in 1970 with no journalism background at all and was hired on the spot as a reporter. Fate seemed to have smiled on the United States in that post-war period, and we made the most of it. We dreamed big, individually and as a society. Americans believed that great things were possible, and they were. This started right after the war, and we had a hell of a run for about three decades. By leading the effort to create the United Nations, the U.S. led the way in the quest for world peace, peace, not war. We developed the Marshall Plan to rebuild Western Europe. The GI Bill made it possible for many veterans to purchase that all-important first family home and get a college degree. In many cases, those GIs were the first members of their family ever to go to college. All across America, we built schools and housing and highways, and we established a standard of living that was the envy of the entire world. These were dreams that we were talking about, not fantasies, dreams that could actually be realized. People fought hard for the things they believed in. Astonishing advances were made during that period in civil rights and women's rights and gay rights and civil liberties. The environmental movement was born. We came to understand that workers and consumers had rights, and even the criminally accused. Much of the greatness of the United States, including so much that we now take for granted, was forged in those amazingly productive and extremely exciting years. Where are we now? As I mentioned, we're once again stuck in a war that can't be won and never should have been launched. That long run of ever-increasing prosperity, the cornerstone of the American dream, fizzled out, believe it or not, more than 30 years ago. Men who are now in their 30s, the prime age for raising families, earn less money than members of their father's generation did at the same age. The median income for men in their 30s in 1974, using today's inflation-adjusted dollars, was $40,200. Those annual earnings have dropped to $35,000. That's ominous. From 1980, that's the year Ronald Reagan was elected. From 19... I take a little drink of water there. Big Ron. From 1980 to 2005, the average income for the vast majority of Americans, again adjusted for inflation, actually declined. The standard of living for the average family has improved, not because personal incomes have grown, but because women have gone into the workplace in droves. The peak income year for most Americans, 90% of Americans, was way back in 1973. Back then, the average inflation-adjusted income per taxpayer was $33,000. That's nearly $4,000 higher than it is today. We're going backwards. My friend and colleague at the New York Times, James K. Johnson, who is an absolute whiz at economics, wrote the following in his latest book, which is called Free Lunch. Quote, "The pattern here is clear. The rich are getting fabulously richer. The vast majority are somewhat worse off. And the bottom half, for all practical purposes, the poor, are being savaged by our current economic policies." That is not an overstatement. It's the plain truth. We get a very skewed picture of how well Americans are doing from the media and from the corporate and political elites. The harsh reality is that 37 million Americans live in poverty, a large percentage of them children, 37 million. Another 57 million live just one notch above the poverty line. Those near-poor Americans live in households with incomes of $20,000 to $40,000 a year, for a family of four. Try raising a family of four on, say, $30,000 or $35,000 a year. They work at jobs that are highly unstable and offer few, if any, benefits. we will soon have close to 100 million people in the United States who are poor or near poor. And if you want to get that in perspective, when Jack Kennedy was elected president in 1960, the entire population of the United States was 185 million people. We're soon going to have 100 million who are poor or near poor. There is a huge disconnect between the sense of America you will get from watching television and the reality you will find as you travel around this country. As I said, a key aspect of the American dream was the belief that each succeeding generation would be better off than the last. But that's no longer such a widely held belief. A national poll conducted for the Change to Win Labor Federation showed that only a tiny 16% of working Americans believed that their children's generation would be better off than their own. A poll cited by my paper surveying people across class lines showed that only a third of the respondents expected their children to be better off than they are. Take your pick. Both polls show the American dream on life support. Without that dream, America is not much. The glory of this country is in the dream. When I was a young man, I could make a cold call to the Star-Ledger in Newark, New Jersey, have the managing editor answer the phone himself, and get hired almost immediately with not a second's worth of experience. I could look through the classified ads in the New York Times, hop on a subway train, and rent an affordable apartment on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, right across the street from one of the main entrances to Central Park. And if you think I'm kidding, it's on 72nd Street, right next to the Dakota. You walk across the street and you're in that park. The important question for us as we move through this election season and beyond to the post-Bush era is, what kind of country do we want? We should be serious about that. Here's an example. Do we want a country that spends a couple of trillion dollars on a god-awful war for oil in the sands of Iraq, but that cannot find the money it needs to rebuild its own aging, decrepit infrastructure? A word here about infrastructure, because it's important. Remember what David Brinkley said about New Orleans. The sinking of New Orleans was a man-made debacle resulting from the poorly designed levees and flood walls. Another man-made disaster was the collapse of the Interstate 35W bridge over the Mississippi River in Minneapolis, a bridge that plunged 60 feet into the water at the height of rush hour, killing 13 people. It's a miracle more people weren't killed. Refusing to repair and properly maintain the nation's infrastructure is like ignoring the rotting roof of your home until it collapses on your family and kills somebody. It makes no sense. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates that we would have to spend more than $1.5 trillion over a 5-year period to bring the U.S. infrastructure, its roads, bridges, schools, levees, water treatment facilities, electrical grid, and so forth, into just reasonably decent shape. Are we doing that? No. There are other issues. Do we want a country where so many kids in the inner city grow up poor, never work at a regular job, and never think in terms of careers, marriages, honeymoons, home ownership, and the joy of raising a thriving family? Do we want a country in which 6 million young people aged 16 to 24 have dropped out of high school, and that's not counting those who are still in high school but won't go on to graduate? This is occurring at a time when a 4-year college degree has become a virtual prerequisite to a middle-class quality of life. Is that the kind of country we want? Do we want a country where, in this subprime mortgage fiasco, more than 2 million households are expected ultimately to face foreclosure? 2 million households. So think about the number of people. Think about the number of kids who are going to be out there, lost their homes. The mortgage swindlers descended like vultures on the poor and the ignorant, and I covered this story. They were offering loans not on the basis of whether the homeowners could afford them, but simply on whether they could breathe. If your heart's still beating, said one broker, you qualify. That's how an old woman in Chicago, Rosa Daly, an old woman who was sick and nearly blind, ended up destitute. I visited her last fall. She was defrauded out of her home. When I saw her, she was behind in her mortgage payments, and foreclosure proceedings were already underway. This poor woman was petrified. She's sitting in her house freezing because there was no heat, and she just thought she was going to be on the street, and she was sick and blind. They had brought mortgage papers to her in the hospital, and the woman's blind. She can't see what she's signing. The guy said, oh, just sign right here. It's no problem. They wanted to seize the equity out of her house. I asked her what she planned to do for Thanksgiving. I'll be here, she said. I've got some cornflakes and canned vegetables. That'll be my Thanksgiving. There are literally millions of stories like that across the United States, and you won't see most of them on television. Health insurance? I wrote about Brittany Hightower, a high school cheerleader in Texas. She was being treated for cancer when her mom's health insurance maxed out. Her mother nearly lost her mind trying to round up the money to keep the treatments going. It's impossible for me to say how this affected Brittany's treatment, but I can tell you it nearly ruined the rest of the family. Brittany fought like crazy to survive, her mother told me. But like my friend Michael Farmer, she didn't make it. She died last June, age 16. Somewhere right now, there are youngsters Brittany's age who are struggling with devastating illnesses, whose families don't have health insurance, and some of those kids are going to die because of that. Is that the kind of country that we want the United States of America to be in the year 2008? Let's talk for a moment about crime and incarceration. If we're thinking about what kind of country we want, we should ask ourselves, is it the kind of country in which over the course of the 2006-2007 school year, 34 public school students in the city of Chicago were murdered? Over the course of one school year, 34 kids murdered. We haven't heard much about that. We don't hear much about crime at all in this country unless it involves a celebrity or unless some good-looking woman disappears and is thought to have been murdered, which is a specialty of cable TV. But consider this. Since September 11, 2001, when the nation's attention understandably became focused on terrorism, no one has been killed in a terror attack in the United States. But over that period, nearly 100,000 Americans have been murdered. 100,000. That's a bloodbath of gigantic proportions. We don't hear much about it. And then there are the prisons. Americans constitute 5% of the world's population, 5%. But we've got 25% of the world's prison population. 1/4 of all the prisoners in the world are locked up in the United States of America. And yet we still have these staggering numbers of homicides and other violent crimes. Seems to me that we're doing something wrong. And just a few more words about the financial plight of ordinary Americans. What seems to be happening is that working Americans, and that includes the middle class, have exhausted much of their capacity to tread water. Wives and mothers have long since entered the workforce. Mortgages have been refinanced, and tremendous amounts of home equity drained. And families have taken on debt loads for cars, for college tuition, for medical treatment that would buckle the knees of the strongest pack animals. Americans owe some $900 billion, that's nearly $1 trillion, on their credit cards, just on their credit cards. When I was a kid, people used to look forward to a peaceful retirement. Now people hit their mid-60s with incredible amounts of debt to pay off and no defined benefit pension plan. Andy Stern, one of the top labor leaders in the country, told me the current retirement strategy for many young workers is basically to work until you die. Now, you've borne with me, and I appreciate that. After this long litany of woe that I have subjected you to, is there an upside? No, we're out of here. Just joking. Yes. In fact, what I wrote here is sure. Yes, there is, and I'm serious. As a society, we've come through much harder times than these. This is not the Great Depression, and it's not World War II. This is not the Jim Crow era that black people had to struggle through for so many decades. Opportunities for women are no longer as circumscribed as they were in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. So we know we can get through this. And I don't have a sense, as I travel the country covering this election, that the American people are apathetic. They are hungry for leadership, and I think many would like to contribute themselves. So that is a hopeful sign. But while this is not as bad a time as the Depression or World War II, I do think it's a worse time than many Americans and many of our leaders realize. At the same time that we are saddled with these major economic problems and a debilitating war, the U.S. is going through a transitional period, at least as important as the early post-World War II period, and we're not prepared for it. New worlds in energy, technology, the economy, and global interdependence are either upon us or coming fast. Change is coming at us far more swiftly now than they did in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, and God knows the rest of the world is far more competitive. So what are we to do, those of us who care about the country and are disturbed by the current state of affairs? The first thing we have to do is admit that we have a problem. We've been pretending for too long that things will somehow right themselves, that maybe the fix that the country is in is not as bad as it seems. And maybe if we finally elect the right president, Hillary or Barack or John McCain or somebody named Huckabee maybe, that person will put us on the golden path. Get over it. That kind of quick fix is not going to happen. Things, in fact, are likely to get tougher in the short term, not easier. It's going to take a big effort and real sacrifice from all of us to make things right again. I wouldn't for a moment deny the crucial importance of this year's presidential election, but the election of a president, even one who is thoughtful and capable and wise, is just the first step. If we're to move forward as a country, the thoughtful members of the electorate, people like you and me, who care about the society we are creating for ourselves and will be leaving to our children and grandchildren, are going to have to take steps to intervene in our own fate. Just casting a ballot is not enough. We have to make real demands on our leaders. We can't just sit back and say, oh, well, they screwed up, we're in another war, or that was a bad policy. You know, now 2 more million families are going to lose their homes. You know, isn't that terrible? That's not enough. We have an obligation to do more. And I think that means participating more actively in the civic affairs of our nation. There are times when the citizenry needs to raise hell, and this is one of those times. Only tremendous pressure from the electorate, for example, will bring our involvement in the war in Iraq to a close, and that's absolutely essential. Because just like that war took our attention away from the real problems of terror in Afghanistan and allowed bin Laden to set up shop in Pakistan and have a good laugh at our expense, that same war is taking attention away from the enormous challenges we face right here at home. And of course, the war is consuming staggering amounts of American dollars, money that we desperately need if we're going to seriously address some of the problems I've been talking about here. If we're really going to move ahead and resuscitate the American dream, we have to be willing, all of us, to make an enormous collective effort. I mean it. Speak out. Talk seriously to your friends and your colleagues at work. Offer your services as a volunteer where you think you can make a contribution. Join a local civic organization or start one. Don't just vote for candidates you admire. Help them. Work in their campaigns. Run for office yourself. Write letters, articles, speeches. Write a check. There are things you can do, and as corny as it sounds, and it does sound corny, your country needs you. We can't just depend on the politicians to get us through this. As the late, great Texas Congresswoman Barbara Jordan said, government is too important to be a spectator sport. When I asked Al Gore last June if there was any chance he might jump into the race for president, he wasn't able to hide his disgust with the political process, and it wasn't just because of his experience in 2000. He told me, quote, what politics has become requires a level of tolerance for triviality and artifice and nonsense that I find I have in short supply, close quote. This triviality and artifice and incompetence at the highest reaches of power in a period of profound change is itself a sign of a society in trouble. So we need to step up ourselves whenever and wherever we can. Don't sell this idea short. The so-called ordinary people can do wonders. The free speech movement here at Berkeley in the 1960s was a profound moment in the fight for civil liberties in this country. The blacks who sat in at segregated lunch counters in the South or who refused to ride the buses during the Montgomery boycott in the mid-1950s changed the face of this nation. The millions of women who stood up boldly for their rights and put up with grotesque harassment decades ago were absolutely crucial in bringing us to this moment in 2008 when a woman has a genuine shot at being elected president of the United States. So when I say the country needs you, I mean it. We can no longer afford to waste the energy and talent of people who can make a real contribution. Wasting talent is how you end up fighting wars you shouldn't fight and losing cities to a Category 3 hurricane. We are going to have to figure out new ways of doing things. We've got to cast our leadership net far beyond the preening, posturing politicians to bring in the very best that America has to offer. We need to draw on the creative and intellectual resources of a great school like this one, for example, and the many other wonderful institutions of learning that dot the length and breadth of this land. We haven't begun to tap into the explosive creative energy embedded in the heart of this nation. We need to call on our teachers and professors and college and university presidents, our foundation's heads and activists, the smartest and most progressive minds in the corporate world and the labor movement. We need to bring in everybody and use that brain power and energy and creativity to address these big problems that we're facing. You and I will have to contribute, and we can't afford to wait until we're asked. Figure out a way to get your voice heard. Figure out a way to do something. You know, sometimes you can actually feel the winds of history blowing, and this is one of those times. Think of all those moments in the past when ordinary people stepped into those prevailing winds and helped shape some of our proudest achievements. We can't afford to remain indifferent as history unfolds around us. If we don't shape the face of this nation in these early years of the 21st century, somebody else will. It was nearly half a century ago that Jack Kennedy said, "We can do better." It's time to take him up on it. Thank you very much.
Of Edward R. Murrow and Lewis Hine and other members of your profession who pulled aside the curtain and said, this is the light on what's really going wrong in this country. We must change it. And it was that influence of journalism, of broadcast media, photojournalists that launched a lot of the movements that you've spoken about. What do you see as the role for the profession today, and maybe is it moving away from the New York Times? Where do you see the vitality, and what's the responsibility?
It has moved away. I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I mean, I think that fundamentally was the role of journalism. So you have a model there. You can look at it just like you had a model in Vietnam about what not to do. Here we have a model in journalism of what you should be doing. But we've gotten away from that. I mean, even the Times gets infected with some of the nonsense of tabloid journalism and personality and that sort of thing. And I think we still do a lot of great work, the reporters at the Times and that sort of thing. But the profession is in a bad place right now, and newspapers are, almost in their death throes. So when you look at when you have a big story, for example, like this presidential campaign, I remember the older anchors and reporters, whatever you may have thought about them, I mean, they would cover this stuff and they'd be on the air almost round the clock in some cases, but they knew what the hell they were talking about. I mean, they asked serious questions and they would confront people who were telling them nonsense. Well, now we have like these 24-hour news cycles. It's CNN, it's MSNBC, it's Fox News, and, you know, and it's this incessant chatter from the talking heads, of which every now and then I'm one of the heads up there talking, you know, but you're not really getting the sort of revelation that you're talking about. And there was a time when the anchors had to have had a great deal of experience, very often starting in print journalism, and they could not be on that set as an anchor until they knew what the deal was. That's no longer the case. Now it's a pretty face. Whether it's a man or a woman, you just put that person up there, and a lot of times they're nitwits. A lot of times they don't know what they're talking about. So I think we need to get back there, just like I think that we need people, more ordinary people, to become civically engaged. I think the profession of journalism, and this school is a place that takes journalism very seriously, just like the New York Times still takes, for all its failings, still takes journalism very seriously, and so does the Washington Post. But I think that journalism needs to take a look at itself and figure out how we can raise our standards to get closer to what we once were. And I think it's really ironic because, and this is counterintuitive, the people in the profession now are smarter, better educated than they were in general back in the time that you're talking about. And certainly there's far more journalistic outlets. I mean, you know, you can just, well, I don't even want to talk about that. You can be overwhelmed by it. And yet I think that the public is not really well informed, and I think that that's in part because the public is not making enough of an effort to be well informed, but also largely because the media are not doing a good job at informing the public.
Thank you for coming tonight. If you have further questions.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.